Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
It's transfer deadline day, and this is Defending in Numbers, where we walk down the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about football than we actually do. My name is Rob Armstrong, and it always has been. And joining me today is Jake Entwistle. How are you doing, Jake?
Yep, great to be here.
And the excellence of elocution. Yeah, George Elec. How are you doing?
Hi, mate. Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Is everyone excited for transfer deadline day? Jake's already threatened to get his top off, so are we in that kind of mood? Is it a top off the deadline day kind of mood?
It's a swing your shirt around your head sort of day. It's going to be exciting stuff.
And George, who are Oxford signing? Messi?
Apparently we're getting someone from the Swedish second division, so I'm looking forward to that one, to go along with that Azerbaijani left back.
I personally can't wait. All right, then, get your tops off with the week by numbers.
The week by numbers.
All right, George and Jake, I know you two love numbers. And we're going to start with number 57, which is the number of England caps that Jermaine Defoe currently has, which is the most of any outfield player in the current squad. Next is Gary Cahill with 55. Does that say that England have a lack of experience, or are we just bringing through a new crop of talented youngsters, or do we need a few more old heads in there?
I think that experience is important when it's good experience, and I think that Jermaine Defoe, for all the fans he has around the country, I think he's the fact he's in our squad is a damning indictment of it, really. He only scored 10 goals from open play last season, and people say he was playing for a bad Sunderland team. I think that part of the reason why Sunderland were bad was because he was in it, and you're basically playing with 10 men when he's on the pitch. So yeah, I think that Southgate's new regime, he came in promising kind of a new generation of talent coming through, and he hasn't really provided it.
Oh, I completely agree. There's no need for experience when it isn't going to add anything to your side, and you've got players like Jermaine Defoe who, as George just said, is not going to offer you that much. He will score you the odd goal. He obviously came back and scored after God knows how many games where he didn't play, but I really feel like now with Wayne Rooney's retirement, that should be sort of the signal to bring in a new era. The England youth teams had unprecedented success this summer. We won the first ever under 20 World Cup. We won our first under 19 championship for a while. And I just feel like if you look at the models of Spain and Germany and countries like that, the reason they are so successful is because they have a group of players that play together for a decade. And I think we've now got the chance with, I'm not knocking Wayne Rooney at all. He obviously was a very good player.
Sounds like you are, Jake.
But I just think now, Gareth Southgate as well, the fact that he was under-21's manager, I feel like he knows that level a bit more. And we've seen with the introduction of Nathaniel Chalobah into this squad, I think there's a real sign that we might start forming a younger base to the side and slowly phase out the older members. And I think that can only be a benefit for England.
I mean, you know the under-21s are ready because they've lost to Germany in a penalty shootout, so they must be ready for the step up to the senior side.
The word experience alone, like, these England players who've been around for 10 or so years, what have they experienced? Like, failure.
Pain.
Like, consistent failure. Heartache. So you're bringing in players into a squad who all they know about is losing at major tournaments, and that's, like, the opposite of what we want. Like, Jermaine Defoe's come in, he's been knocked out of, like, 5 major tournaments.
So we have been particularly bad in the last 10 years, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, what have they experienced? Fine, they've been playing the Premier League a lot, they've been there, they've done that, played a lot of football, but when it comes to England camps and England dressing rooms, I don't think they're going to add much to it.
Nice to have your home fans booing you. The quote that defines a generation of footballers. Next number, you pests. 17, the number of successful dribbles by Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain so far this season, more than any other Premier League player, followed by Paul Pogba with 12. Why do Chelsea and Liverpool want Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, and do they even want him? Is it just his agent saying, well, I'm going here?
Oh, I think they do want him. I think it looks like at the time of speaking, he's turned down a move to Chelsea in favour. He wants to go to Liverpool. I think the reason you know, teams are wanting him, but fairly obvious. English talent comes at a premium, and for squad quotas and stuff, it's important to have them. He is a very, very talented footballer, as well as being a very good athlete. He's got pace. He's good on the ball, as you've alluded to. He can dribble with it and take it forward. He can play in a variety of positions, which I think at Arsenal has been his downfall, basically, because for the last 6 years, no one's known what his best position is. But I think, you know, the benefits of having him on your team are quite obvious in your squad, and also for 35 million quid in this market, it's not very much money.
You're an athlete and a talented footballer, as well as someone who knows Arsenal maybe too well. Yeah. What does Oxlade-Chamberlain bring that the top sides might want?
Well, What they won't want is the frustration he causes at times. I really think he's one of the best in the league, and it's shown by the fact that he's dominating this statistic already, at isolating a player and just breezing past them. The only problem is his decision-making can sometimes let him down. And when he's acting on pure instinct and burning past players and just firing it straight across, that's when you see the best of him. And I think in a system like Arsenal's, where it's too slow sometimes, that's when his weaknesses come to the fore. But in a team like Chelsea or Liverpool, whichever he decides to move to, if he does move at all, there are teams that are sort of high octane, high action, and that's his playstyle down to a T. We saw Chelsea play against Spurs when they won at Wembley, and they were sort of using their central midfielders and wide players to an extent to just carry the ball forward on their own, sort of one-man clearance machines. And I think Oxlade-Chamberlain can be that sort of player for Chelsea. He's obviously apparently declined the move because he doesn't want to play right wing back. And although I think that's where he would play the most at Chelsea, because Victor Moses, again, he's got the attributes that suit that role, and Conte's just moulded him perfectly to a tactical weapon in that sense. So I think Chamberlain would benefit from that at Chelsea, but I could also see him, despite what he thinks, maybe playing a more central midfield role and using him to just bring Chelsea up the pitch as a sort of a bulldozer alongside Bakayoko, who they've just signed. I think there was a clear emphasis on having central midfielders that can carry the ball forward on their own. And for Chelsea, I think he'd be a valuable asset in that sense.
As long as they don't give him time to think. It's a bit like a midfield Carlton Cole. Like Carlton Cole, the minute you gave him a second to think, awful. But, you know, in those split seconds, he'd produce magic. I'm telling you.
That's a serious hot take.
That is the hottest of hot takes.
I'm glad we're here to tell you what's actually going on in the football world.
I remember Carlton Cole, right? Let's just delve back into Carlton Cole memories. We were playing against Spurs and he scored a left foot volley. You give him no time to think, he'll score a volley from 35 yards and then literally from kickoff.
It was on purpose.
Literally from kickoff, he got the ball, passed it straight to Jermaine Defoe, who scored. You know, you've got to play to,
the strengths
of a genius, haven't you? All right, next number. 3. Big numbers, big numbers. The number of league games Gareth Barry needs to play to overtake Ryan Giggs for the most top flight appearances in the Premier League era. Peter Shilton is the most overall, all time, with 849. But Gareth Barry, how has he silently gone about being Premier League don, workhorse?
Just by playing in loads of positions for loads of seasons without ever really getting injured for loads of different teams. And it's laudable, to be honest. He's progressed. I think when he came through the ranks at Villa, he was initially an attacking player. And then when he kind of broke into the first team, he was a left back. And then he went to City and became something of like almost a kind of a box-to-box midfielder for a time there, holding predominantly defensively when he was a bit more of an athlete. And then Everton has just become a man who, a bit of a crab, who likes to foul. And now he's moved on again. So, you know, we talk often about Rooney. Rooney's biggest defenders talk about how many times he's managed to kind of redefine himself as a player. And you think that Gareth Barry is someone who's also been able to do that.
As a species, now as a crab, apparently.
yeah, like metamorphosis. But, you know, the guys who are going to have the most appearance in the Premier League are always going to be the ones who stay fit, and he's stayed fit and stayed useful at the top level for a long time, so good on him.
And he's now in a team that I think will be perfect for him as well.
Crabs.
Yeah. But Tony Pulis said, after their recent game, he said, Gareth Barry was the only player that looked fitter as the match went on. So I think that testament to what George just said, really. Gareth Barry's carved out this career by being just a superbly fit athlete. And at times he has been a good player. For Aston Villa, he was sort of on every set piece, taking penalties, scoring goals, and was their talisman. And then he sort of regressed further down the pitch. And he's been humble about it. I think that's why it's been such a long career. He's never had any gripes that I need to be number 10 at at 36 years old. He's sort of realised what his capabilities are and what his limitations are. He's moved back. And at Everton, as George said again, he was just fouling. He was there to... he was there. That was his role, and he played it well. He's the most booked player in the Premier League history as well, and there's a reason for that. It's because he's become an enforcer that maybe doesn't have the pace and strength of a modern-day enforcer. So he's there. He's bringing people down, but in a team like West Brom as well, that will be sitting back...
Bringing them down, but lifting people up.
Yeah, exactly. He's carrying the team, but also felling the opposition, so...
So in like 15 years' time, is this going to be James Milner on his 48th birthday.
Yeah, could be. I mean, he started when he was 16, didn't he? So yeah. At Leeds, so you know, very easily could be
120 under 21 caps.
But I think if, I mean, there are rumours that you know, Krakowiak's going to be going to West Brom. And if that's true, you can see them being a pretty decent partnership, and that they're both going to be very hard to break down. They're both going to be very good at, you know, winning possession back. And then Barry's the perfect foil for Krakowiak, because he'll just give him the ball, and he's a fantastic kind of deep-lying playmaker. We saw for Poland, especially in the Euros, that he's really, really good with the ball at his feet. He's more than just a defensive midfielder. So that could be proper midfield too, if they can pull that off.
Let's drop down a division to Leeds United. The number of goals that Leeds have scored in all competitions in August is 16, the most in their history. And that's without now Burnley striker Chris Wood. Leeds, are they finally going to return to what they once were? Champions of Europe?
Very early
days.
They
weren't champions of Europe, champions of England.
Semi-finalist of Europe.
With Lee Bowyer at the helm.
I'm surprised how they're doing, because they lost Gary Monk to Middlesbrough, who got them within touching distance of the playoffs before a really alarming slide at the end of the season. And Wood obviously started the season playing, but he's gone to Burnley now. And their transfer policy this summer, they brought in Christensen, who's a left field appointment for manager anyway, and they brought in players from all over Europe who no one's really heard of before, and it looks like their recruitment strategy has been spot on. And their sporting director, whose name escapes me now, but he worked under Monchi at Seville, so he's got pedigree of being a proper, you know, someone who knows how to recruit players. Kemar Roof is a player that I know very well, because he played at Oxford, and he was played chronically out of position all last season on the right wing. I basically don't think Monk knew what he was buying. I think he thought he was buying a winger when he actually got a striker. He scored 4 goals in the 2 games since Wood left, playing in a striker's role, which is a dagger through the hearts of Oxford fans who thought we might have a chance of getting him back on loan. But you know, it's very early days, and you feel like there's something of a new manager bounce. You feel like there's something of a new player bounce as well, because they've got this new squad in. So let's not get carried away, but at the moment it's looking really, really positive.
Do they still have the nutcase owner, Cellino, is it?
No, he left, so it's now an Italian businessman.
Oh, well, that always ends well. Yeah. Jake, how much of Leeds are you seeing?
The transfer policy that George mentioned is something that's interested me, and their particular player that they've recently just bought is this hulking 19-year-old Dutch forward called J. Roy Grot, I think is how it's pronounced.
What a name. What a perfect name for a Leeds United forward.
And I just think, in terms of the fact that they sold Chris Wood, this guy could be, he's not a like-for-like replacement, and I'm not expecting him to score the most goals in the Championship, but I just think it's a sign that a bit of excitement might be brought back. I watched this guy play in the European Under-19 Championships, and he played against England and was genuinely up front, holding off 4 or 5 players on his own, sort of a one-man team, because England were dominating the game. And I just think signings like that will sort of bring the excitement back to Elland Road. And in the league this season, they've created the third most chances in the division and had the fifth most shots. So we're talking about them scoring a lot of goals. They're also sort of getting in the final third, and there's definitely an attacking fluidity to their play, and they're trying to play football the right way. So I think with the combination of a new manager, some new players in, as George said, they might be riding the wave a bit at the beginning, but I think the signs are there that they could make a push. They were obviously close last season, so any improvement might see them move into that top six.
There is nothing more exciting than Grot. I can tell you that much, guys. Do you remember Grot bags from, is it Emu's World? That might be that might have gone over the head of everyone.
Yeah. Listeners,
I think it was like an old witch from a children's TV show. Grot bags.
Absolutely no idea.
Anyway, right. J. Roy Grot. One of my favourite witches in history. And next number is 600%. That's 600 out of 100. That's how much Ousmane Dembele's transfer value has increased in a single year after signing for Dortmund for a reported €15 million in 2016. He's now moved to Barcelona to replace Neymar for €105 million. What are we getting with Dembele then, Jake? I know you've got a very special word for this.
Well, yeah, so the word that I want to use is ambipedal.
It's grotback, no.
Yeah, it's grotback. But no, seriously, Ousmane Dembele is almost a marvel in a sense. And again, it sounds like I'm completely hyping up. He's obviously 20 years old. But when people talk about footballers need to be able to use both feet, a lot of them can use both feet. But it's rare that you see someone that's so natural and you genuinely don't know which foot he is. When France played England recently and they made us look silly, he was just running through everyone. A sort of interview resurfaced of him when he was at Rennes, and he was talking to the interviewer, and the interviewer was saying, "So which foot are you?" And he said, "Left footed." And he said, "But you shoot with your right." And he goes, "Yeah." "Why do you shoot with your right?" "Because I shoot better with it." And so after that, I jumped into all the numbers and looked at it. And it turns out that he scored more goals with his right foot. He has more assists with his left foot. He takes more shots. He's got a better conversion rate and a higher shot accuracy with his right foot. But all his creation comes with his left. So I think this massive increase in transfer value is it's obviously distorted in the fact that figures this season are ridiculous, but I think he will be worth the money. He is a similar sort of player to Neymar. They both love to dribble. They'll both rack up tons of assists. And in the Champions League last season, Neymar was top of take-ons. Neymar was top of assists. The player behind him was Dembele. So if you're looking purely at numbers and metrics and tables, Ousmane Dembele is the perfect replacement for Neymar. He's definitely not as good as Neymar is now, but at 20 years old and in a team where it's probably the worst time to join, but I feel like he might get more responsibility because of that. I really think they've got a really exciting player. And genuinely, when you see him running down the wing, crossing it with his left and then taking a penalty with his right foot, it's something really enjoyable to see.
He sounds like a real sick freak.
I think the best thing about him for people who haven't seen him much is just how incredible he is to watch. Like, you get those players who are just, you know, Messi is certainly one of them, who is just an absolute treat to watch them do what they're doing. He'll collect the ball from deep and he'll get you on the edge of your seat and get you standing up, because what he's good at is a rare thing, and he's so young and he's so raw. He made his debut for Rennes in September 2015, so under 2 years ago, and that was in Ligue 1. He'd never played professional football before that.
And they got a load of the money from the transfer as well, didn't they?
30 million euros.
So they broke their record without selling a player, right?
Yeah, so that's pretty good for them. Everyone was a winner, really.
I think it's a massive signing. And I think that in Neymar, they obviously had a world-class player who's absolutely brilliant, but not on the level of the two others that, you know, stood in his way for those Ballon d'Or for so long. And I think that in Dembele, by the time those two have gone on, it'll be Neymar and Dembele, amongst others, who'll be fighting for it as well. So,
great tragedy for Neymar.
He did commit the crime of trying to do a rainbow in his presentation.
It was horrendous.
He genuinely. The thing is, though, you could
he
tell
really
he was
bothered with it. Did
you
he?
could tell he was 20 years old in that.
I'm looking forward to all the people who've watched that and gone down to the pubs and told their mates how bad he is.
Yeah.
Just to end up watching him, being like, actually. Oh, they know more than just seeing him do keep up. He's at that. Okay, cool. He's good. Yeah.
To be fair, though, Paulinho.
Yeah.
Barcelona managed to spend 145 million on six pick-ups, whatever. Anyway, tops off for I'm Embarrassed to Ask.
I'm Embarrassed to Ask.
Right. I'm Embarrassed to Ask this week. Since it is deadline day and everyone has broken their transfer record by 6 million%. Financial fair play, right? Firstly, what is it? Secondly, does anyone still use it? Thirdly, who is it even helping? Right, so PSG have just spent nearly €500 million, right, on Neymar's transfer fee and his salary. And then Barcelona are going and spending €105 million. PSG are looking like they're going to spend however much on Kylian Mbappe as well, even though it's on loan, but they're going to put it back to next year. Like, financial fair play this year, from what I know of it, doesn't seem to really exist, right? Because they're still just spending huge, huge sums of money.
But it's a common misconception that it's there to kind of stop teams spending money. It's there to basically prevent debt. And that's the important thing, because too many football clubs are spending beyond their means in an attempt to kind of try and force success. And therefore, that's what UEFA kind of stepped in to try and prevent. Everton, for example, are able to get away with it because of Romelu Lukaku. And that, you know, that £75 million fee just goes straight into the plus column and they can just spend that at their will. Despite the ridiculous increase in transfer fees this summer, if you actually look into the details, it's normally consistent within what revenue a club brings in to what they spend on transfer fees. And because it increased TV deals and the like, actually the percentage of revenue that clubs are spending on transfer deals hasn't really even gone up. It's just the case revenue spiked, so therefore the transfer fees are spiked. So these huge sums of money aren't actually necessarily getting people in trouble for FFP because they're earning more. Having said that, if you're looking at PSG specifically, you know, the Neymar deal has obviously taken out a big chunk of what they're allowed to spend. So if you're looking at what they're doing with Mbappe, it looks like they're probably going to sign him on loan for the first year and then buy him next year. Naby Keita to say the same
just
thing.
Just like the second loophole in Ronix. Didn't they give Neymar the €300 million personally?
There are so many loopholes. I mean, if you look at, you know, PSG have come unstuck by it in the past, and Man City, but then if you and you get docked how many players you could have in your European squad, but then if you sort it out in a certain amount of time, then the punishments get rescinded. If you look at what AC Milan are doing, there's within FFP, there's a loophole saying if you've been taken over by new owners, you have 3 years to sort your finances out before you get punished, which basically means that AC Milan have just gone absolutely bananas and they'll worry about it in a couple of years and try and sort it out. And then to explain what it is, you know, people on Twitter just replying with FFP to when their rival... When their rival clubs make a signing, I think I'm missing the point somewhat. It's not there to curtail spending. It's there to stop these big businesses who are spending beyond their means and therefore getting into financial difficulty. We've had it, seen it so much in the UK with Leeds, you know, especially about a decade ago, Portsmouth as well. You know, when clubs get the sniff of the big time and they try and overspend in order to maintain that, it can be really, really damaging. And what we're seeing as well is smaller clubs, because the TV deals are now bigger revenue. So the likes of Burnley spending 15 million quid on Chris Wood could never have happened 5 years ago. The fact they now can isn't really an issue with FFP because they're earning such money from the TV deals.
Barry to West Brom. Reply to tweet, FFP.
I think it was on a free transfer as well. So there probably was still some loophole in it. But the financial fair play in general, I think, is just confusing more than anything. And I was looking at the numbers behind it as in typical fashion of this podcast, and the general rule is, I couldn't believe it. I still had to read it twice, but it's if you spend over 5 million euros of what you earn, that's technically a breach, which seems incredible because that again that just reflects how much you're earning. But then I saw that immediately afterwards they said, oh, but if you end up putting it back in, or your owner puts it back in, you can spend 45 million euros over. But this year we're moving that down to 30 million euros. But it's just the fact that that's such a massive gap between, right, this is the rule, don't spend 5 million euros over what you're earning. Oh, wait, no, you can spend 45 million euros. That's where the confusion lies, the fact that there's, they say that, oh, it's not a percentage thing, so this suits lower clubs because they'll probably never ever spend 5 million euros. So that bracket for them is great. But it just sort of, again, it just reflects badly on the big clubs. And I suppose that's what everyone focuses on.
The weird thing about it is if you look at the sanctions, you know, PSG and City are probably the two most high profile clubs to have got big fines. But then because they balanced their books, they then got reimbursed 2/3 of their fine like a year later. It seems a bit troubling.
What's the point of fining? They've got too much money.
You're basically just paying a premium in order to do it. And the confusion lies... I mean, I'm not going to name names, but a certain national chief sports writer for a national newspaper who have a very big showbiz section wrote an article saying Everton are benefiting from the end of FFP. You know, FFP hasn't...
So it's helping them. It's not stopping them. It's helping them.
The fact that clubs like PSG are saying, yeah, we'll buy your best player, one of the hottest young talents in world football, but we'll loan him for a first year and we promise to pay you next year. That's where I think surely there has to be some sort of rule where... I know that is in the contract that you're paying them next year, but I don't see how that can be allowed. And it's just weird that these rules are extended over 3 seasons. It's not just based on 1 season. If someone's putting money back in, then it's all fine. Your ban gets rescinded. You get your players back. It just seems like they're really sort of piecemeal solutions to it. And if they really want to implement it and sort of make it so that teams aren't spending this... massive amounts of money, which again, as George said, I don't think is even the point, but I just think there needs to be a bit more clarity and in terms of when teams do it badly and do breach it, then there should be serious sanctions for it.
There are so many loopholes though, aren't there? I
just think one thing to remember is it's not for the fans. Like,
why not? Nothing's for the fans anymore.
It's for the business and it's to keep football in check. And whilst, you know, there's a kind of an irony about the contradiction of fans wanting their clubs to spend these huge fees on transfers and getting angry about other clubs not falling foul of FFP. You can't have it both ways. Football is now just this multi-billion pound industry and that's going to lead to problems, and this is here to stop those problems happening to clubs rather than let fans kind of get annoyed about other clubs spending money. So I think it is important. I think it's not clear what it does, but again, I don't think that's much of an issue.
But it can't, like I said, with the paying Neymar the money so he bought out his own contract thing, like, why are there so many loopholes of it? I might be imagining that, to be honest. I imagine a lot of things, but I feel like I remember Man City's owners who also own Etihad giving money from Etihad to Man City to get around financial fair play, right?
But that's just the world of business. I think that happens everywhere, and football's going to be no different. People are always going to find ways to pump in more money than they're probably allowed to, allegedly.
What's interesting about it as well is you're allowed to spend as much money you want on infrastructure and training facilities and youth development and stuff. So they're really trying to sort of pigeonhole it to transfers, and they're trying to make clubs sort of better themselves from within. But the fact that so much money comes in, and I think the desired impact of it to make clubs better and promote youth and build greater training facilities, I don't think that's working, because that's not the best business model. You don't earn loads of money by waiting 10 years to bring up this one talent that you've nurtured in your academy. You win titles by buying the best players. So even though they've tried to encourage people to spend in other areas, because of the loopholes and because, as George said, that is the way business works, it's still just always going to revolve around immediate transfers and spending as much money as possible to get short gains.
Basically, financial fair play is a football club owner lying in bed with a hangover extending his overdraft, but his bank only lets him extend it so much. Unless you've got a loophole, which is like rich parents, right?
Or you've got new parents and you've got 3 years sorted out.
Exactly. They've just adopted you. They've got three years to spoil you until you slowly grow to resent each other. I understand a bit more about that now. I'm still just going to complain about it. And on that note, let's get our tops off for Who's This Fella?
Who's This Fella?
Right then, you two monsters of the night. Talk to me about Naby Keita or Keita. I'm saying Keita. I'm saying Keita because he's come from Germany.
He's brilliant.
Okay. Liverpool fans will agree with you because apparently is the next big thing. Yeah, best thing since sliced bread.
He's a very complete midfielder. I've seen him compared to a lot of players, and I think that doesn't really do him justice. The Kante comparisons are well wide of the mark because he's way, way better going forward. I'd say even the Vieira comparisons are probably also off the mark because...
the Maradona comparisons.
Probably more, you know, probably about right. Because basically he's someone who you know, his natural position is quite deep on the pitch, and he is tenacious and he's energetic and he breaks down play well. But his key ability is basically carrying the ball forward and then creating. He's got unbelievable final ball. He can finish as well. Some stats of his last season at Leipzig. He 1,403 passes, 83 take-ons, which I think Jake will tell you is the most in Europe.
It was the most by a centre midfielder.
There you go, the most by a centre midfielder in Europe. 82 interceptions, 53 tackles, 8 goals, 7 assists. He can basically do it all. And the good thing for Liverpool is that their midfield three, as it were, is pretty stagnant, I would say. It's pretty static. Henderson and Chan are both obviously very talented ball players, especially Chan. I think his potential is huge, whereas Henderson's, you know, never going to be able to reach that elite level. But then in certain games, he is, you know, he's a very good kind of deep-lying playmaker.
Gareth Barry.
Just about.
Years away from evolving into a crab.
I know, and Wijnaldum's very good at knitting the play together. I don't think he's, you know, he started the season very well, but Keita's on a different level to them in terms of his athleticism, in terms of his end product, in terms of his ability on the ball. And I think that he will completely revolutionise their team. From that area, we've seen so often with Liverpool how poor they are at breaking down teams who sit back. And I mean, Keita's eyes will literally light up if he gets the ball from, you know, just inside his own half, and he looks up and he sees space in front of him with two banks of four. He's just going to drive at it, and that's going to not let teams sit back against them anymore.
Where was he before? Because I mean, he's only really coming. I mean, I'd never heard of him before. Has he only been there for a season? Because I mean, Amizaki's had a good season, right? And he wasn't worth all this talk. So, how do we know that this is not just one season wonder? Because RB Leipzig had like an incredible year last year,
and they were sort of like the Monaco of the Bundesliga in the terms that sort of no one expected them to do well, and they obviously didn't dominate the league because they came second, but they performed well above what everyone expected. Even though they would probably argue that they knew they were going to do well, that their team was perfectly set up. I think the transition from RB Leipzig to Liverpool will be a really easy one for Keita, because George said that he'll definitely help breaking down back fours, but I think he's going to absolutely just make even better Liverpool's counter-attacking. He's going to add so much to the fact that he can win the ball. We talked about 80 interceptions, 80-plus take-ons. That was the only player that posted that high in both numbers in Europe's top five leagues last season. He's going to be devastating when he just reads the play, nicks the ball in front and just drives forward immediately. That's probably what they lack at the moment. Emre Can is quite a powerful runner, but although he throws out an odd step over, but he hasn't really got that guile, and he sort of drives straight line running and he'll get you up the pitch, but after he's done the running, that's probably where it lets him down. He maybe panics. He's probably better at off the ball running, as we've seen by him scoring goals. So I think Emre Can might have I think Liverpool need to tie him down, and I would play sort of Emre Can and Keita, and then maybe Coutinho in there as well. That sort of front three, if he stays. But that's what I think. Can's got a future, but Keita is sort of a massive upgrade on Wijnaldum, in terms that we saw Wijnaldum against Arsenal. That was the most take-ons he's ever completed a game, which was 8, and he completed 100% of them. But Naby Keita does that almost every game. He's got the most take-ons last season. He's already got 10 this season in the Bundesliga, which is the most out of any player. And it's really frightening to imagine Liverpool just holding back, a team trying to break through them, Naby Keita nicking in front, taking on two players, releasing Sadio Mane. That most 9 out of times out of 10, that's going to result in a goal next season. And
9 out of 10, that's a lot of goals.
This seems like enormous exaggeration to me, because what I'm hearing here is like Naby Keita is the best player ever.
But I think he's got potential to be...
What, the best player ever?
No, possibly, yeah.
Well, that is...
Well, no,
I took a hot take. That's outrageous.
Who am I to say? He can't be. He's young. What is he, 22, 23?
We're all young, George.
Yeah, you could be too, mate.
I'll get training.
The other thing about Keita, you say he's one season wonder. His form at Salzburg, where he played with Mane, so they've got a relationship anyway before, but they're...
Oh, God, they are going to score 9 out of 10
but
times.
But it was good enough that he, Arsenal and Arsene Wenger were very, very keen to bring him in, but then because of the relationship with Red Bull,
classic Arsene Wenger. I saw this player, I nearly brought him in.
And I think from what I've heard, Keita was actually very keen to make that move, but then because of the relationship between Red Bull Salzburg and Rasenbull Leipzig, meant that he went there. But I'm really, really excited to see him in the Premier League.
Rasenbull,
they weren't allowed, allegedly, to call them Red Bull Leipzig because of German.
Yes, I picked that match up.
So it kind of means like racing ball.
Racing
or
ball?
Yeah.
So are Liverpool going to win the league when they've got him next year, Jake?
I don't know if they'll win the league, but they'll score.
But he's the best player ever.
They'll score tons of goals, as I said. And 9 out of 10 might have been a bold statement, but it was just to emphasise how perfect I think he is for their system. And they're going to take their play to another level when he joins the side next year.
How come they've done this thing where they sign him a year in advance? Because all the prices I was reading for him were going to be like 60, 70 million and stuff, but now he's only going for 48 million, but in a year's time.
I think this was a huge deal for Leipzig because they are unbelievably ambitious. I mean, Leipzig want to be the biggest team in Germany, like no question about it. They want to overtake Bayern Munich and win Bundesliga titles consistently. And last year was obviously when they kind of really landed on the European scene. And Keita's their best player, with Emil Forsberg as well, but they're their two best players. And if they were to bow down and sell their best player after one season to Liverpool, a team who to be fair, underperformed compared to Leipzig last season. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that last season's Leipzig against last season's Liverpool, I think I'd probably be with Leipzig to win it. So it's important for them not to just cave in straight away to a bids and let their player leave. So I think keeping him for another season shows that they've got that kind of mental resolve. Obviously, Keita wanted to leave, so they couldn't kind of stop him completely. But I think that's partly why they were more willing to take a deal next year.
And sacrifice however many millions of pounds.
Yeah, I think they've saved... Although, because, again, there was reported that his 48 million release clause ran out, so it's 48 million plus a bit of an undetermined number or a number that they don't want to say. So it's a bit more than they would have paid if they signed him this season, but it's also going to be much less than what we'd be going for next year.
So one season of Keita for Leipzig in the Champions League and the Bundesliga could result in them being massive heavyweights in the transfer window next year. So if they can get into the knockout stage of the Champions League and finish second again, then they're going to be an incredibly attractive prospect for young footballers across the world, really.
They must be absolutely loaded as well. They must be riddled with loopholes.
Absolutely loaded, yeah. They don't need the cash.
What loophole do they use? They're just like, oh yeah, we've got this huge crate of Red Bull drinks.
We're going to get a lawsuit from Red Bull if we're like this, so we've got to be careful.
It's worth 400 million euros worth of Red Bull just turned up at the door. We've sold it all on eBay immediately. It's fine. It's all profit. Anyway, tops off for the Stat Showdown. Jake, put your trousers on.
Stat Showdown.
All right, we have two straight shooters here, specifically with stats. Which one are you gunslingers? Is going first. I'm looking deep into your souls. Jake wants it more. Jake needs it more. Jake, you've also got a bit of a moustache going as well, which makes you think this isn't your first, you know, showdown. I know it's not because you did one last week, but it's not.
I'm trying to grow into the role completely, embracing the showdown. Yeah. So my first stat, going on the England theme earlier.
Ooh.
I thought this was really interesting. So Nathaniel Chalobah has got his first England call-up, and he's actually played more top flight minutes this season for Watford, played 270, played every minute of every game, than he's managed in his entire career before that, which includes at time at Chelsea and time at Napoli. So 270 minutes compared to 254 minutes in his previous four or five seasons.
That is good. That is good.
I'll do an England one as well, obviously.
Shoot straight with it, though.
England looking for a new captain. The most likely, the favourite of the bookmakers is Harry Kane. We all know Harry Kane doesn't like August. Last season, Harry Kane, in all season, scored 29 goals for 110 shots. That's one goal every 3.8 shots. So far in the Premier League, he's had 24 shots and he's yet to score a goal.
Okay. All right, you've both shot. The stat bullets are flying into each other's directions, but one of you has shot straight but slightly in the wrong direction. I'm going to say, Jake, you shot straightest with that one. You take a 1-0 lead. George, come back at him.
All right. So David Villa has been called up to the Spain squad for the first time since 2014 World Cup, which is actually when he moved to the MLS. In his whole Barcelona career, he scored 41 goals at 0.54 per 90. Since being in the MLS, he has scored 60 goals in three seasons at 0.7 per 90. So fair enough. Great decision.
He's scoring goals, Jake. Can you score the goal here?
I'll go international, and I'm going to go looking a bit to something that might happen.
All right.
And Robert Lewandowski is currently on an 11-match qualifying scoring streak. So if he scores in his next match, he would have scored in 12 consecutive European qualifiers, European Championship and World Cup. And he's only 2 goals away from equaling the most ever scored in a European qualifying campaign.
I'm a man who loves a bit of nostalgia, and for me, David Villa is a nice nostalgia act. A 35-year-old man. George, I think you've shot straight into Jake's arm there. You're both walking wounded, looking at each other. Drawing your stat guns up for one final shot.
See, this is where a decision. This is why I shouldn't prepare more than 3, because now I don't know whether to go with my main man Kylian Mbappe or
I reckon you're
going to go with that.
I've got an Alexis Sanchez one as well. A bit of propaganda. I'll go with Alexis Sanchez because he's most likely to move today. So this is a bit of people can use this. Since moving to the Premier League, Alexis Sanchez has misplaced the most passes in the entire division. 1,075.
75. That was a good stat. George, come on.
I might just fall on my swords.
I mean, I physically exhaled.
I thought I was going to be 2-0 up here, so this is my weakest of the lot. Can you come out with that? This is terrible. I was unbeaten for this. England go to Malta this weekend. They've only played Malta away twice in history, and both of them, they won, but only by one goal margin. 1-0 and 2-1 away at Malta.
That is a weak stat. Well, England have only beaten a minnow 1-0 twice. It's hardly surprising.
1-0 2-1.
1-0 2-1.
Yeah. Emil Heskey scored the winner last time. That's probably the stat, isn't it?
Emil Heskey
scored.
They're so bad.
Instant win. And Martin Keown got the opener. I mean, that's a good conversation.
That was so much better.
You should have gone for that.
But you didn't.
And Richard Wright scored the own goal for Malta.
Oh, God. Imagine if you'd gone for that. You wouldn't be lying dead on the floor riddled with stat bullets.
At least the listeners know now, though. That's a good thing.
I once bought a Richard Wright goalkeeping shirt. I didn't know his number as well, so I got number one. He was never number one at Arsenal.
Right, brother.
Well, Jake, you've left George lying in a pool of his statty blood. Jake, where can people find you on the internet if they want to also be ridden with stat bullets?
If they want more stats fired at them, the best place for me is on Twitter, at Jake Entwistle, Entwistle, no H, you won't find me.
That's his full name on Twitter. And George, where can we find you?
Yeah, on Twitter as well, at George Elek, Elek.
That's his full
name. I was about to say, that's also not got a H in it.
It's his full name. And my full name on Twitter is also followed by an underscore and a WH. It's at Rob Armstrong underscore WH for a tweet every 7 months. And we'll see you next time on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.
Deezer Originals.